Welcome to the Village Square. It is a treat to be back with you tonight, and I really appreciate that kind introduction, Rabbi Romberg. I'm amazed that Liz and Rabbi Romberg invited me back. The last time I was with you, I was with my friend Steve Vancour, a Democrat pollster and consultant, and we told you in September that under no circumstances was Donald Trump going to be elected president. And so I'm really appreciative of being asked back, although they're asking me not to speak, but to lead the question portion of this, which is probably appropriate. So thank you for that. It is a treat to be here, and you're lucky to have Liz and Rabbi Romberg sort of leading the charge here. And I wanted to say hi, Brian DeLoge, our county commissioner, is here, the president of the National Association of Counties. That's right. So he is leaving again in the morning. We appreciate all you do. And I think I saw former Representative Alan Williams somewhere in the audience sneaking in and out, and I know there are other dignitaries and VIPs that I'm missing, but welcome back to the Village Square. I'm proud to be a member of the Village Square. I've been a member, I think, for 4 or 5 years maybe, and it's a treat to be here, and I'm grateful for what you guys do. It is really my great honor, though, to introduce my friend Pete Wehner tonight, who has flown in from Virginia to be with us. You have a copy of Pete's biography in your program. There are a couple things I want to highlight. Pete is a fellow at the Center for Ethics and Public Policy, or Ethics and Public Policy Center. He is an opinion columnist for the failing New York Times. We all know that's just fake news, so you're nice to have Pete here. We welcome Pete. But Pete was the assistant director of speech writing for President George W. Bush, President Bush 43, and he was also the head of the Strategic Initiatives Office. Those are the big thinkers who really problem-solved for President Bush in the White House. And Pete actually also worked for President Bush 41, and for Bill Bennett in that White House, and I worked in the Political Affairs Office, and I don't know how we did not meet at that point in time. When Jeb Bush was thinking about running for president, many people did not know this, but I was privileged to be in on that process, and I asked him at some point, who are you going to talk to about whether you should run, and who are the top 5 people you want to speak with and get their advice? Pete Wehner was at the top of that list. Pete is humble. Many people do not know his name, although they may have read his incredible columns, they may have looked at or read his books. Pete gives incredible advice. He is a strong conservative thought leader. He's a conservative's conservative, and he has also been one of the most outspoken critics of the Trump presidency. And so I want to ask him a little bit about this tonight, but I want to thank Pete personally. We were in the 2016 election cycle was interesting. I think that's an understatement. And for someone on the opposite side of the Trump campaign, it was a huge challenge. And Pete did not endorse a candidate in this race. I think he helped anyone who reached out to him for advice. But there were many times when I went to Pete and said, I have no idea what to do. And Pete would usually provide us with great counsel and direction. But the thing I really appreciated the most about Pete is that he is a very faithful person. Quietly faithful, great humility, and there were many conversations I had with Pete when I was away from my family and on the road and under great pressure, and Pete would say, I'll pray for you. I'll pray for Governor Bush. And a lot of people say that, but it's just sort of a throwaway line like, have a great weekend. They don't necessarily mean it. I knew that Pete was praying for us. I wished he'd prayed for victory a little more. But nevertheless, he had his priorities in line, and he prayed for wisdom and for sanity, which was really important to us. And it's just really a treat to get to lead you in the questions tonight and welcome you to the Village Square, Pete. So come on up. So are you willing to tell us a little bit about yourself? I know that your impressive biography is in the program, and we talked about it, but you and Cindy have 3 children. You've been looking at colleges. There's a whole other side to Pete Wehner. I'm sorry, I know that keeps doing that. I'm not sure why.
Sure. I will be happy to give a fuller account of me and my life. First, I want to thank you for hosting this, and Liz and the Village Square, and all of you who support it. This is my first time down here to participate in this, but what I know about it and what I've learned about it is really terrific. I think that this is the kind of thing that has to go on in more cities across America, because I think it's really important to the well-being, not just of your community, but really for the nation, and we can get into that. But it really is a pleasure to be here with you and with you, Sally. And I really got to respect Sally even more during the campaign and Governor Bush. And I think I probably did pray for victory, but sometimes your prayers aren't answered. So life is like that. My own history, I was born in Dallas, grew up in Washington State, and east side of Washington State, went to University of Washington in Seattle, and I majored in political science. I was somebody that was, for about as long as I can remember, was interested in politics and the ideas behind politics. So I remember we had a cabin that my parents owned, and we would go there almost every weekend and listen to the news, top of the hour, and I would have these conversations with my mom and dad about why is this happening, you know, when Israel and Arab nations went to war, why don't they get along? So I was drawn to that when I was young. My favorite class in high school was social studies. My teachers were liberal, I was conservative. I didn't know why I was conservative, probably because my dad and mom were. But I really like them, and in fact, I'm in touch with my teachers to this day, and still in communication, and have very fond memories of them. Went to University of Washington Political Science. It was a good school. I was a pretty good student, but not a great student. But again, politics was of interest to me. I remember I would go to Susilo Library and listen to John F. Kennedy's speeches on my own time so often that I actually began to memorize them. And I remember reading the books about the Kennedy administration, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Ted Sorensen. And I thought when I was young, boy, that would be great to be an aide to a president. And I came out to D.C. on an internship and really never left. I got a job after the internship ended. I was at Center for Strategic International Studies. And then my career in government began in the Reagan administration. I was speechwriter for Bill Bennett when he was Secretary of Education. And then the George H.W. Bush administration when Bill was so-called drug czar, and then in the Bush White House. So politics and the ideas behind politics have been a part of my life for most of my life. I should say that when I got involved in politics, I wasn't cynical about it. I thought that it was an important thing and an admirable thing, and I'm still not cynical about it, even all these years later. That doesn't mean that I haven't run across people and situations and circumstances that weren't problematic. But overall, I think politics is still a noble profession and an important one, and I think it's important that we get it right, which is part of the reason why I admire this group. I've married my wife Cindy and I, and we have three children, John Paul, 19, Christine, 17, and David, 13. So we're there still in that busy phase of life, and being a parent and a husband has brought me tremendous joy and also humility, too.
Speak up.
A little louder?
Okay.
I'll go a little louder. And I one other thing just probably to know about me is I'm a person of, so you know, kind of background. We can get into this if you want. Person of the Christian faith. I became a Christian in the end of high school. Faith did not come easily to me. I was a person that had a lot of questions and still do to this day. But my faith has been a part of who I am. It's informed, I think, my politics, even as I've been very skeptical throughout the years about or wary about the tension between people of faith and politics, because I think there are real inherent tensions there. But that faith has really been kind of central to me and helped, I hope, shape my character and my outlook. And right now I'm a writer and a commentator, and I hope I bring a certain advantage to my views on politics. I've been a practitioner for a fair amount of time, including in the White House, and I've been able to write and comment on it. And I can tell you that your IQ goes up about 50 points when you leave government and begin to critique others who are in government. It's a lot easier that way, as it turns out.
Well, we are going to talk about your faith, with your permission, tonight, and also some of the columns you've written. I thought I would start with, and because Liz told me that this is going to be a dining room table, a dinner table conversation, I'm going to actually move this back, because I feel like I'm so far away from Pete, I'm not having a conversation with him. So if it's okay, I'm just going to move these right here, and I'm going to move this table over here.
Perfect.
Does that work? And now I'm going to move my chair. That seems more like a kitchen table conversation, at least, doesn't it? So I wanted to divide our conversation into three areas to start with. Uh-huh. Obviously, you write a great deal about ideology. You're
right.
A conservative. You write about humility, which I find particularly refreshing in the public dialogue and lacking. And you write, a lot about your Christian faith. So I'm going to start with ideology, and we can skip around, and then we'll come to the audience. And you guys, Liz will have a mic, I think, and Bill is ready to go when we get to that point. Can everybody hear me now? Okay, good. You are a strong conservative. But you recently wrote, quote, "We're all aware of the irritating patterns we see in others, bending facts in order to fit pre-existing views, searching out data that confirms one's position while ignoring data that undermines it, answering the weakest rather than the strongest arguments, setting a field of straw men ablaze, imputing the motivations of those who hold different views, and so forth." And what really struck me is this line. You say, "What's much more difficult is detecting those patterns in us,"
right,
"to see the little games we play on ourselves and on others, to recognize when our intellectual integrity is compromised by a commitment to a predetermined set of beliefs." I was really struck by this column because you wrote it in 2011, I think. So we are 5-6 years later. It's possible things are even further down the path you describe. Why is this, and how do we reverse this trend, Pete?
Yeah. Why is it? I think it is because it's part of human nature. I mean, I think we all suffer with this issue of what sociologists call confirmation bias and motivated reasoning. And I know I do too. There's just a way in which we see a set of facts or a set of arguments, and because we have decided, at least a lot of us, we're either liberal or conservative, or even moderate for that matter, and we begin to interpret that data to fit what we believe. And I'll give you a kind of real-life example, and you all may have your own versions of this. Let's say that you are you're an opponent of gun control, and there is a study that comes out in favor of gun control. Let's say it's an NIH study of an analysis of 50 different independent studies, so it's a meta-analysis. And you read that, a lot of times what your first instinct is not to say, how serious is this study? I got to read more about it. What's the validity of it? What is it that I can learn from it? It's, where do I go to what website or what author or what organization do I go to refute this study? Because it can't be true. It can't be true because I have my beliefs, and this is a challenge to my beliefs. And I just think we do that all the time. It was one of the things I really could detect in myself and in other people when I first came to Washington, was this idea that we would just go and we would cherry pick the data that we wanted. So I think we're all susceptible to that. Why has it gotten worse? I think in part it's gotten worse because we're more polarized politically as a society. I think because of social media, the advent of social media. So there's just it's much easier than it used to be to live in a intellectual, political, social silo. And you can today, in ways that you never did before, really surround yourself
with people who just confirm what you already believe. We even do that more and more personally. It was interesting, you know, there was years ago, people used to say not to bring up in dinner conversations politics or religion because it would get you into fights and into arguments. And I remember reading about a year ago in the Washington Post, it was a professor at University of Maryland who says, actually, that's no longer the case. Is the dinner parties now are people inviting folks that they agree with, and all they talk about is the same faith and the same politics because you're guaranteed not to have any arguments. So I think that what has happened is that there is this predilection that we have, and for a variety of reasons, those things have been reinforced. Some of it has to do with the advent of technology. Some of it, as I said, has to do with the increased polarization of these times. And, you know, if you're a liberal, you can get up in the morning and watch MSNBC and read your favorite liberal columnist and go to your favorite liberal websites and go to sleep happy because everything that you thought is confirmed. You can do the same thing with a conservative. There you would do it with, you know, with Fox News. So I think that's what's been going on. In terms of how do you get out of it, you know, it's a complicated question. I think there are probably some structural issues that have to do with politics and the nature of politics, gerrymandering, and how the parties have ideologically sorted. But I do feel like what is extremely important is that you have to make a conscious effort to get people into your orbit that have standing in your life, that sees things different than you. And the reason that that's important, the reason that it's important to get people, I think, with some standing in your life, is that you need people to be able to challenge you where you don't immediately suspect their motivations and think they're wishing me ill will. It's just a different category of interaction. If you hear from somebody that you know is a friend of yours, somebody that loves you, someone that cares for you, and they say, I think you have this wrong. Now, you still may disagree with them, and you still may argue with them, but it's just a lot harder to dismiss it. And so I think that's a lot of it. Jonathan Haidt, who a lot of you may be familiar with, he's a sociologist, moral psychologist at NYU, used to be at University of Virginia, and wrote several marvelous books, but one of them is The Righteous Mind, which really is on this subject of motivated reasoning, confirmation bias. And he's written about how the best chance that we have to try and widen the vistas, open the apertures of our understanding of things, is to have people in our life, friends in our life that we can communicate with. It tends to get away from the dehumanization of politics, and hopefully people, you know, in their quieter moments, can give serious thought if somebody with that kind of standing comes to you and says, I think you've got this wrong, or I think you need to revisit it.
So how are you intentional about that in the midst of being in the chaotic and divisive climate that is Washington, D.C.? Can you give us some specific examples of things you do?
Yeah, I mean, in this last election, I guess I can start there. I am a lifelong Republican, have been a lifelong Republican and conservative, and I was a very vocal critic of Donald Trump for reasons I'm happy to go into with you or during the Q&A if you'd like. But I had very, very deep differences and disagreements with him, and I didn't vote for him, which put me at odds, as you can imagine, with a lot of people in my party and a lot of people who were sort of fellow travelers with me over the years. But I did intentionally stay in touch with people who were strong Trump supporters. Some of them were in the church that I attend. Some of them were very public, vocal Trump champions in the conservative media world. And I made an effort to be in touch with them, often via email. And you know, we would have our differences and we would go back and forth, but I tried, and I think they tried for the most part, not to personalize it. And I was intentional about wanting to hear from them to say, what is it that you think that I don't see about Donald Trump that I need to see? Because I really did want to try and understand where they were coming from, particularly because for me, when it came to the appeal of Donald Trump, I was just tone deaf. I didn't get it. In fact, I had very much the opposite reaction. But I did know enough to know that not everybody, and not anything like everybody who was a Trump supporter, was a malicious person. They had a different point of view. You know, I was at on a panel at Stanford right before the election with Arlie Hochschild, who is a historian sociologist. And she wrote a lovely book called Strangers in Their Own Land. She is a liberal, teaches at Berkeley, so you can imagine she's a liberal. But she did something that I thought was really admirable. She wanted to understand, at this point, her book started when the Tea Party was on the rise, and she disagreed with it politically. But rather than dismissing them and mocking them, she wanted to understand. So she went to Louisiana and spent years there going back and forth to get to know the people of Louisiana who were supporters of the Tea Party. And she developed an affection and a fondness for the people, and she was struck by their kindness to her. And she still thought that they were wrong, and she was able to document what their feelings were. But this humanized it for her, and she was at least able to articulate what their worldview was. And I remember, because this was right before this election, and when we were talking, quite apart from the panel, when we were just chatting, the two of us, and she talked about the humiliation that a lot of these people felt. They felt like that they were being left behind by the modern economy and the modern culture, and that there was this humiliation that they had felt, and they had been looked down on, and they felt like Donald Trump had given voice to their frustrations. Now, she didn't change her mind, but this was somebody who was at least able to understand it. So I tried to do that, and I've tried to surround myself with people and here, not intentionally, but just because of the nature of my life, that don't share my politics, particularly in a couple I'm thinking of were people of my faith who were quite instrumental, actually, pivotal figures in my own pilgrimage of faith, who saw politics differently than I do, some liberal, actually somewhat more liberal. And to be able to have them, and sometimes if I would write or speak, I would actually have them in mind. There was one person in particular, Steve Hainer, who was a kind of spiritual mentor of mine. And I would from time to time think, what would Steve think about the argument that I'm making? Would he think it was intellectually honest? Would he feel like I wasn't dehumanizing the other person? So, you know, that's how I've tried to do it. I've done it imperfectly. I've written things that I'm sure have gone over the line. But as I said, I think I'm at least somewhat aware of my own waywardness here, and so that's one of the ways I've tried to check it.
Well, so continuing on the question of ideology a little bit, you and I share the experience of having been, you have a much bigger platform through the fake news of the New York Times, but we have argued with Donald Trump, we have disagreed with Donald Trump, and it can put you in an awkward position. I have found personally where there were conservative friends of mine who we had done battle together for 30 years for the Republican Party who disagreed with my decision not to support Trump and called me expressing great concern for my sanity, very worried about me. And then I found liberal friends who embraced me and said, you finally, you know, come to the right side of the aisle. It's all working. Alan did not do that. He knew better. But I had an interesting conversation with Pete recently, and you said, it is because I am a conservative that I had to speak out against Donald Trump. And I thought that was interesting. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Sure. No, I'm happy to. I think I viewed Trump in sort of separate categories as it related to conservatism. One would be sort of a set of issues that people associate traditionally with conservatism. Then there's a sort of underlying philosophy, right, that informs conservatism. And then there is what I would describe as a kind of conservative temperament or attitude, style, disposition. And I thought on each of those levels he was very problematic. I think probably on the least problematic, as it relates here, would be on the set of issues. He's not by any means a conservative. he's, and even to this day, if you took issues like limited government, free trade, I would argue immigration, up until recently, you know, conservatives were, Ronald Reagan was very different on his views of immigration. He was very open to immigration, very sympathetic even to illegal immigration. And it was an idea of kind of open borders and open society, free people, free economy. And his view of America's role in the world, which I think is sort of quasi-isolationist. Trump is a fierce protectionist. So I think on a whole range of issues, he either isn't conservative, or certainly in his recent history hasn't been conservative. Now, I do understand, and I had this discussion endless number of times with friends of mine who said, look, he may not be a complete conservative, but surely he is going to advance more conservative policies than Hillary Clinton. And I said, yeah, that's a reasonable expectation because she's a person of the left who was pulled to the left during the campaign. So if your standard or my standard was simply how you check the policy box, I probably would have voted for Trump, not enthusiastically, but because I think he probably was going to do better. And I think he showed that, for example, with the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. But that's not where I would stop. I do think that Trump's underlying philosophy is in many ways contrary to conservatism. I think he is, as best I can tell, an ethnic nationalist. And I think the animating forces behind his politics are contrary to how I understand conservatism. And the one thing that Donald Trump could do that Hillary Clinton never could do is redefine the Republican Party and the conservative movement, precisely because he is a Republican and he would be the de facto leader of the conservative movement. And I felt like if Donald Trump defined conservatism as he understood it, as opposed to how I understood it, that would do tremendous long-term damage in a way that Hillary Clinton could not. And I think if you take somebody like Steve Bannon is not only, in my estimation, not a conservative, I think he's an enemy of conservatism, at least as I understand it. And the last reason was really, for me, the most important reason. The older I've gotten, the more experience I've had in government, the less value I have put on how you check the policy boxes and the more value I've placed on temperament and what I would call character, broadly defined. And the reason that I do that is, having been in the White House for 7.5 years and having studied history and a lot of presidencies, there's just no way to anticipate the issues that are going to come up. You know, John Adams said, life is a theater of vicissitudes. Things change all the times. When I joined the George W. Bush administration, he was for a humble foreign policy. It was not going to be central to his presidency. He was going to be a domestic president, and along came 9/11, and his presidency was transformed. There are just too many things that come up, and you can't say in how a person checks a policy box how they're going to react. What you really need, and what I think is most important, is a kind of prudential wisdom, somebody who is balanced, who is stable, who has foresight, who has the ability to see the pattern of events unfolding before the rest of us do, someone who has judgment. And I just felt that Donald Trump, when it came to issues of character and temperament, was not only worse than Hillary Clinton, he was worse than anybody I had ever seen. And so I didn't feel like he was a person that I could in good conscience vote for and give the presidency to. To have those qualities in a reality television star is one thing. I think to have it in a presidency is different. And I do believe that in my understanding of conservatism, my reading of conservatism, that whole notion of what I think would be called a kind of Burkean conservatism or Michael Oakeshott, which is a certain view of life, a certain modesty and humility of politics, an understanding of the unintended consequences, that life is endlessly complicated and you can't possibly know how things are going to unfold. And that whole constellation of kind of judgment and wisdom that we prize and value, I think that's most important in a political leader. And then apart from that, there would be how one conducts oneself in public life. And I just found him to be crude and cruel. The cruelty just really bothered me. When I saw him mock the reporter with a disability and the family of fallen war heroes, I don't get that angry in politics that often, but that really angered me. And I felt like it told me something about him, about his soul, and I didn't like it. So I didn't feel like I could, in good conscience, support him.
Okay, there's so many directions I want to go on this, but I have to ask you, we talked about this a little earlier today when we had a few minutes. You have written that you are hardwired for hope. You have also written, and I'm going to paraphrase this, and if I mess it up, please correct me, but that it takes big moments, big personalities, big people in public life to rally the troops, to move the needle forward in one direction or another. So you're hardwired for hope. We have a big personality. You want the needle to be moved in a certain direction. What do you hope will be the good that comes of this period in American democracy? What do you see? What are you forecasting?
That it ends? I would say, I think I am probably hardwired for hope. I think that's probably my disposition on most things, though hopefully I'm not Pollyannish about it. Look, at this particular moment, when I look at politics, there's not a lot to be sanguine about as it relates to things that I think interest a lot of you, which is this polarization and the incivility that is now characterizing American politics. But I'd say I think there are several things in terms of how to think about it. One is to be careful not to romanticize the past, which I think there is a tendency to do that, to think that there was a golden age where everything was the kind of land of milk and honey, and people sat around in the most civilized way and talked about issues in a high-minded way and came to agreement, and that was that. That's never happened. It doesn't happen in a free society. It's the nature of human societies in general. And if you go back and look at the history of America, the election of 1800 between Jefferson and Adams makes a lot of what we see like a garden party. And we did have this period called the Civil War, which was extremely contentious. We had the 1960s, a period that was the country was more fractured than it is today. And in a lot of ways, there was violence in the street, burning of universities, burning of cities. So that has gone on for a long time, and we have to be careful not to romanticize the past. Second is just an appreciation, really, for what I think America is, which is a country of tremendous resilience, and has a tremendous capacity for self-renewal. That's just been the story of America. It's been an uneven history, and it's been a country with failures and successes. But generally speaking, I think that the direction of it has been, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of the universe bends toward justice, and I think that the American story, more or less, has bent toward justice, and that's not all the time, and it goes up and down. The third thing I would say is that it's a mistake to think about politics simply through the national lens. The politics that goes on at the federal level, for a whole variety of reasons, tends to be more polarized and more contentious than what happens in Tallahassee and Olympia and Austin and other places. And so I do think that what you see a lot that's going on, in places around the country where governors and state legislatures and people of different parties get along pretty well and they come to agreement pretty often, and life, is unfolding. I think that's an argument really for federalism, and this may be a moment in which federalism gets a certain kind of boost. Republicans generally philosophically have liked federalism because they believe that more power ought to be returned to states and localities philosophically. I think liberals may be find some attraction to federalism today because Donald Trump is president and Republicans control the House and the Senate. So that's going to be less attractive. So there are a lot of stories of politics being practiced in a pretty good and decent way that we ought to see. And I'd say the fourth thing is that there is a lot of public unhappiness and disaffection going on with the way that politics is being conducted. I think if people were satisfied with what they're getting, that would worry me more. There's just a lot of frustration. I mean, I was in Dallas on Sunday. I very rarely travel on weekends, but I did in this case. And I was speaking, and it was on this subject. And it was to a group of people that were deeply concerned. You all here are concerned about it. Other people are concerned. And you're doing something about it. I mean, the Village Square and what you're doing and the Faith Food Friday, which I was told about, which are these ministers and rabbi that get together one Friday a month to talk, that is something that is happening. There's a phrase in philosophy, you can prove the possible by the actual. And you're just showing actually these things can happen. This is very Tocquevillian, right? This is the notion that when there are problems in America, Americans tend to be a pretty ingenious people, and they find ways to work around it. And a lot of times that happens at the local level. And I think that is happening. And I think that once the public begins to really put a premium on what they really, if this is what they want, if they have a certain view of politics that's different than what we're seeing now, that will eventually translate its way into politics. On the other hand, if they don't, you know, then we're just going to have a problem. And that is really an issue that goes to the soul of the American citizenry. We're not captive to forces beyond our control. We are not being attacked from without. Whatever problems we have are problems from within, and that means that we have the capacity to change it. But that really requires Americans to get engaged and to say, this is what we don't like, and this is what we do like, and this is what we're going, you know, to do about it. The last thing I would say is, you know, you can't think that you're planting beautiful flowers and have an ugly garden. I mean, if you look at the garden of politics and say, this is really awful and ugly, we do have to look within, because it is not as if these people are just coming out of nowhere. They're being elected, and people are putting them in this position. So, I mean, ultimately, we've got to have a conversation with ourselves and decide what kind of people we want, what kind of politics that we want to have. And if we decide that, then the politicians will change.
It's interesting. You write a lot about, Pete, about humility, which I know, you know, you also talk about in the context of being a strong, practicing Christian. But you wrote recently, I think it was, about moderation. And I found this interesting. The title of the column was Moderation is Not a Dirty Word. But you didn't mean it in sort of a moderate political view type of way. You say moderation does not mean truth is always found equidistant between two extreme positions. Nor does it mean that bold and at times even radical steps are not necessary to advance moral ends. Moderation takes into account what is needed at any given moment. It allows circumstances to determine action in the way that weather patterns dictate which route a ship will follow. Can you give us some examples of that and what you meant by that?
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of times people think that moderation, they attribute, I think, certain kind of false qualities to moderation. They think that if a liberal is here and a conservative is here or a Democrat is here and a Republican is here, that somehow the right answer is right in the middle. And that's not what moderation is, and that's not what truth is, and that's often not even where the right position is. I mean, if you would stipulate that there was, you know, in 1963, there was Martin Luther King Jr. and Bull Connor, it wasn't as if the truth was somewhere right between the two of them. That just wasn't true. And King had truth and justice on his side, and Bull Connor and George Wallace did not. And some of the great change agents for justice in American history were not people who were just kind of namby-pamby and wishy-washy and on the one hand, on the other hand. I mean, these were people who had a deep sense of justice and fought for it. And indeed, some of the great, really the great figures in American history were that kind of person, people. They were people who were polarizing. Lincoln, you know, I mentioned earlier, who to me is the, probably the greatest American who ever lived. But I mentioned Martin Luther King Jr., Franklin Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, Bobby Kennedy. I mean, a lot of these people were kind of polarizing in their own way. And moderation is not somebody who just doesn't have deep commitments. I think moderation is a kind of, again, a sort of a temperament. It's ability to look out at the world, to see the complexity of the world, and not to be ideological. I've never understood, my interpretation of conservatism has never been ideological. It's much more experiential. I mean, this would be a Burkean conservatism. That would mean, I mean, you have a certain worldview, a certain sense of what justice would be and the right order of human relationships would be. But conservatives, I think, traditionally would take into account human experience and human circumstances and make these adjustments, which was the allusion to a weather pattern. So if you're in a ship and you have a point that you want to get to on a distant shore, that is the right place to get. But you have to take into account weather patterns and the currents of the water. And this goes back to Aristotle. I think he even used the analogy of the ship. You have to zig and zag, and just like doing with a sailboat. That's the way life is, and that's the way that politics is. And I also believe that there is a kind of, you know, moderation. Because you brought up the issue of humility, so I should talk a little bit about it. I spoke about moral humility, which is a separate category, but also what I termed epistemological humility. And that would be the view not that there is an objective truth. I believe there's objective truth. But it is an appreciation or an understanding that that our capacity to ascertain that truth is just limited. That doesn't mean that some people don't get it more than others. I mentioned Steve Hayner to you before, and Steve died a few years ago from pancreatic cancer, and my last conversation with him, I went down to Atlanta. We had a long conversation. I took 11 pages of notes from that conversation, and one of the things he told me is he said, I believe in objective truth, but I hold lightly to my ability to perceive it. And that doesn't mean that we don't try as best we can, but it is an understanding that the world is endlessly complicated, and we can't possibly know. And even if you believed that you had 100% of the truth on a particular kind of set of issues, which none of us have, but let's just pretend that you did, you still can't possibly see the full range of truth. That's why you need other people in your life to be able to widen that aperture, to hear of different experiences, to get different insights, because none of us has the exact angle of vision, whether it comes to theology or philosophy or anything else. And again, that doesn't lead one to relativism. It just means that you don't have this kind of certitude, because when you have that, you've essentially closed down discourse and dialogue. You're essentially saying, I know everything there is to know. Nobody has anything to teach me. And so every conversation becomes an argument in which, you know, you listen not to understand, you listen to refute. And that's just not what the best way to I think, live a fulfilled life is.
Segue to Bill and to Liz and to questions. I mean, you know, the mission of the Village Square is to do exactly what you're talking about doing, which is to meet people who don't look like you, they don't sound like you, they don't talk like you, they don't believe what you believe, and to actually put this into practice, which is what this group has done. So we want you to be able to hear from these folks.
Great.
And then we'll come back and talk about your faith walk. Perfect. A little bit.
Does anybody have a question they'd like to ask? I will fill in with this. Is the 2.5-party system dead? That would be Democrats, Republicans, and Independents.
2.5.
I'm sorry, say again.
Is the 2.5-party system dead? That would be Democrats, Republicans, and Independents.
2.5.
I don't know that it's dead. I think it's weaker than it has been. I think the evidence shows, the social science evidence shows, polling evidence shows, that attachments to parties is weaker than it's been in quite a long time. I should say that that's not necessarily a good thing. It really depends on where you come out on this issue. But let me give a kind of a counter argument for maybe on behalf of strong parties. And if you read, for example, Edmund Burke was a great champion of political parties. And one of the arguments that some very sophisticated people make is that the chaos that now tends to envelop our politics and why a lot of things can't be done is precisely because the parties are much weaker than they used to be. And so you see, for example, with the Republicans and Paul Ryan, who's Speaker of the House, he has a much more difficult job because there's a Freedom Caucus that is, I think, in my estimation, much more oppositional in their mindset than governing-oriented. They have a kind of mental habits that have developed over years where they simply want to oppose. But the party used to have the capacity to control who would run in primaries, and there would be a kind of party discipline that you could enforce that arguably made gridlock less prevalent than it is today. But as the primaries have opened up, and certain special interests have gotten more power, the politics has got both more chaotic and less cohesive. So I'm not sure that the solution is simply to say, well, the parties don't work, and we need less of them, and they need to be weaker. Maybe that's true, because certainly having strong parties has its own downsides. I do think, and I'm guessing the spirit behind the question is that there's just a lot of disaffection with the two parties and politics in general, and that I think is absolutely true. And it's not only directed toward political parties, but if you look across an entire continuum of institutions, there's just a tremendous amount of skepticism and cynicism of institutions in almost every branch of American life. I think one of the few exceptions is the military. But apart from that, that's happening. And so people are losing faith in institutions, political institutions and other institutions. It's complicated because there are reasons for people to have lost faith in them. I think it's reasonable to say that the challenges of this moment aren't being met by our political parties or our political system. And people feel that, and they're frustrated, and they have reason to be frustrated. On the other hand, one has to be careful because there can be a kind of quasi-nihilism that takes place, and people begin to think that institutions are worthless and they can't be salvaged, and you just burn them all to the ground. And we actually need people who care about institutions but have an agenda to reform them and to improve them and to modernize them and to make them more responsive to this moment. And I think that goes for most institutions, including political ones.
So to just tag on to that really quickly, we had John Roush here last spring, who you know, and he had a piece last fall in The Atlantic. And his argument was we needed more smoke-filled rooms,
right?
That the parties needed to be stronger, not weaker. Do you relate to that at all?
Well, after the Trump experience, I'm more sympathetic to it. I'll tell you that, because if it had been the old party system, Donald Trump never would have been the Republican nominee. He was not the favorite of the party apparatus. He was the least favorite of all. And John, if you were here, John is really one of the brilliant writers and thinkers, and is a friend of mine. I like him very, very much. And I thought he made a persuasive case. I don't know that it was a dispositive case, but I'd say that circumstances have strengthened his case over the last year or so.
We've got a question here.
Yeah.
Yeah, in popular America, we like to look down on Islam quite a bit. It's a pretty nasty religion. Mm-hmm. They're very mean to a lot of different people.
Right.
Marginalized people don't do well in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sitting here thinking, in Christianity today, in America, a a lot of marginalized people, people at the fringes, they don't do well in Christianity in America. And conservatism seems to be heavily allied with people who don't do well in popular Christianity. So I'm thinking of bis, gays, transgenders don't do well at all. In fact, it doesn't seem to be a Christianity that's hooked up with the trans love, the transcending power of love. You know, Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself. I'm here to give you the new way in the New Testament. It's all about love. You don't have to know all the Ten Commandments and feel really terrible. You don't have to have all the food things, you know, listed in Leviticus and on and on and on. Just love one another. But that doesn't seem to come up much at all. Modern Christianity these days doesn't seem to take care of families in need. It doesn't seem to take care of all the unwanted children, all the children who are abused. No, no, no. We go after people who are bi, gay, and transgender and try and make their lives hell. And how is it that conservatives are so drawn to that kind of Christianity? Where does that fit in your faith?
That's actually a great segue to some questions I had for you. Can I add to your question on Pete's faith walk? Can I jump in here so I don't ask three different questions?
Sure.
Pete has written extensively about his Christian walk and his faith, and he is a practicing Christian. But what has really struck me is your talk of the lack of humility among Christians. And I'm a practicing Christian, and I had a pastor for years who said that the church is just a hospital for sinners. And I think it's so interesting reading your columns about practicing humility, our lack of humility as Christians, that that is lost. And it needs to come back, not just in the Christian faith and the way we treat others, but in the public policy discourse.
Right.
You want to talk about that a little?
Sure. Let me try and conflate these and deal with them. I'll just say very quickly on Islam, it's a complicated question. I mean, I worked for George W. Bush, who had a very different view of Islam, and actually I thought it was a very impressive moment right in the days after the attacks on 9/11. He went to an Islamic center and referred to Islam as a religion of peace. And at a time when emotions were very raw and it could have gone in a very different direction, President Bush really took a stand. And I thought it was a courageous stand, and I thought it was an important one. I think it's silly to deny that there isn't a problem within Islam. I don't think that jihadism is definitional to Islam, but it isn't as if it's not associated with it. And if you talk to people in the Islamic faith, they will talk about this kind of battle for what might be called the soul of Islam. But if you look at ISIS or Al-Qaeda, they don't represent anything like a majority of people in the Islamic world. But there's some number of people that are there, and this is a very real battle. And I think the effort of some people to completely separate them as if they are not connected in any way is just not a reading of reality. I think you have to understand and diagnose the problem in a fair-minded way to try and address it. But your deeper question, and I think the one you felt the most passionate about, was about kind of Christianity itself and maybe the hypocrisy of Christianity and the lack of love and how Christians are really doing nothing for the poor and standing in judgment of everybody else. I mean, and then I'll come to humility. I'd say several things about it. I've written about this. Look, Christians have failed to live up to their faith commitments throughout their history, and they do it in their lives, and I do it in my life. And so if you measured what my life was in a given week or a given month versus what I think it should be in terms of selflessness and giving, I'm not where I should be. And so I'm not going to stand up and say that Christianity
is a light to the world in a way that I think it ought to be. Having said that, let me maybe give two anecdotes, because I think your characterization, I would say respectfully, is not fair either. And the two anecdotes is this. I invited a person to a church I go to, McLean Presbyterian Church. It was a wonderful church. James Forsythe's pastor, 35, and is a lovely person. And the friend I invited is a gay atheist. And become friends, and he and James and I had lunch, and he wanted to come to church. I invited him to church, and he came. And when we were done, he said to me, he said, if the kind of grace that I felt in this church today I had seen when I was growing up in the city that he grew up in, he said, I would carry a lot less baggage with Christianity. And the second anecdote was I had breakfast and then a meeting with a fellow, an editor, mutual editor that we had asked me to meet with him. He's a liberal, he's Jewish, I think probably agnostic, and he was writing a book on conservatism. He wanted to understand conservatism. And my assignment from the editor was to try and tell him about a conservative world that wasn't a cartoon image of it. We had a very nice conversation, and I said, this is how you're thinking about them. Here are some other things you ought to see if you want a more complete picture. Way to make a long story short, we got together. He went to some churches in rural Virginia. These were comprised of Christians who were pro-gun. He didn't get it. He's a liberal. So he was telling me at lunch, and the pastor, James, said, this I don't get. But he said, you know, when I was there, these people were really terrific. And he talked about all of the different things that they were doing in people's lives to make people's lives better. Poor people's lives, people who were suffering. And he said, here's what I don't get. Why don't you guys lead with that? Why don't you, like, tell the world about that rather than the other stuff? And I said, ask James, because I don't know. My point here is that there is this odd situation, and if you read my writings, you'll be hard-pressed to find someone who has probably been as vocal in their criticisms of the politically prominent people of the Christian faith than I have. But the reality is that Christians and non-Christians, but for the purposes of your question, are doing a tremendous amount of good. If you look at soup kitchens and homeless shelters and taking in kids from the inner city and crisis pregnancy centers, I could go on and on. There's a tremendous amount going on that if the Christian churches were ended, a lot more people would suffer. One of the problems, though, is that a lot of people who are, I think, self-proclaimed Christian voices speak in a way that doesn't demonstrate grace, that doesn't demonstrate tenderness, that doesn't bring what I would argue is a Christian distinctive to politics. And so what you see a lot of times is judgment and anger and fury. And, you know, I'm as offended by it as you are. I may be more offended by it because, for me, it's slightly more personal given my own faith commitments. Philip Yancey wrote he's a wonderful writer, and he wrote a book called What's So Amazing About Grace. And what he did when he was writing about this, doing this book, is it was in airports, and he would just begin to ask people, what do you associate with evangelical Christianity? And the thing he kept hearing were political responses, culture war issues, gay rights, abortion. And he said, never once did anybody bring up the term grace. And it's like, this is extraordinary. This is, from Christian perspective, the core essence, one of the cores of Christianity is grace, unmerited love, tenderness. And yet, people who were seeing it play out in the public arena and in politics didn't associate it with it at all. So I get the problem and the fact that you've got people, and I'm happy to name names, people like Robert Jeffress from Dallas, and Jerry Falwell Jr. and Jerry Falwell Sr. before him, and Pat Robertson and Eric Metaxas,
And I could go on and on. People that I think have spoken about the faith in ways that have done real injury to it. But that isn't the full story that's going on. And just on the question Sally asked about humility, I think it's a civic virtue, and I think it's a Christian virtue. And indeed, I know it's a Christian virtue because it says so in Paul, when he's describing Christ, talks about the humility of Christ, who didn't consider co-equality with God to be seized, but he came not just to become the incarnation, but to the point of death on a cross. And Paul himself in Corinthians talks about being the foremost of sinners. And he talks about seeing through a glass darkly, meaning we can't see things as they fully and truly are. And I think it's an important Christian virtue, and it certainly should be a moral, there should be a moral humility, because we ourselves, if we're honest with ourselves, would know, you know, how much we fall short, and how even when we do good things, or let me speak here for myself anyway, even when you go out and do good things with the best of motives, your motives get corrupted, you know, and tainted. It's like pride is there and other things are there. And that's just a kind of ongoing battle. And I just feel like we've got to have that awareness. I don't take, by the way, humility to be self-abasement. I take it more to be self-forgetfulness. I mean, C.S. Lewis wrote about this. It's essentially thinking of yourself less and other people more. But I do think it's undervalued more, you know, broadly in the culture, but within Christianity too.
Bill, Liz, do you have another question? I've got a whole list, so.
Here, I'm going to go over here. Becky?
Last Saturday was Earth Day. Mm-hmm. And I recall back in 1970, the first Earth Day, and there was legislation passed by bipartisan effort to protect our water and our air. Right. And we were having major problems then with burning rivers, and some of you may remember this. Today, now years later, our Earth is in worse shape. And scientists do agree that climate change is man-made. That's beyond debate. And yet we have climate deniers that are associated with conservatism. Mm-hmm. As you are a conservative, I would like your perspective on the subject of the partisanship and the politicization of climate change and the impediments to a solution on this.
And actually, can I frame this up a little bit? This is Becky and Stuart Parsons, and they're very centrally involved in a local organization we have here called Sustainable Tallahassee. It does a lot of local work on environmental issues.
Great. Terrific. Thanks for the question. Yeah, happy to take it up. A couple of things I'd say. Yes, in some ways I think the Earth is in more difficult shape, and we'll get to that in a second. In some ways it's better. Actually, I think you're right that one of the outstanding progress that we've seen has been, for example, in air pollution. If you looked at where air pollution was in the 1970s and where it is today, at least in the United States and with our waters, there have been great advancements in making our environment cleaner in a lot of ways. That's actually been a success story. And the early Republican Party, actually, Teddy Roosevelt and others, was a very pro-environmental party. That was very much a part of the history. On climate change and global warming, you know, you're talking to the wrong guy in one sense if you know, in terms of making a case that global warming isn't happening. I wrote an essay with Jim Manzi in National Affairs for people who were enormously bored and want to read an essay on it where we laid out what the science was. And I think it's just a matter of physics that, of course, the Earth is going to warm up because of human beings and human activity. That just makes sense if you understand the science of it. And I was worried and have written about the Republican response. I think it was a two-step response. The first one was to say it was a hoax. Jim Inhofe, I think, wrote a book to that effect. He's a chairman of one of the Senate committees, and so he would deny that it's even happening. So there are some people on the right in the Republican world that had said for a long time it's a hoax. You hear that less now. So the second
iteration of this was, well, I'm not a scientist, so I can't really speak to that question. That wasn't terribly persuasive because you may not be a tax accountant, but you speak on tax matters if you're a member of Congress, or you may not be a teacher, but you have to make decisions on education. So that was a dodge, right? That was a fear that, look, the science is showing one thing and we don't want to go there. I will tell you what the perspective, what I think is driving some of this, and then make one other comment. I think for people on the right, the reason that there is this resistance to the global warming and climate change is that they have a sense, and I think that in some ways this is a legitimate sense, that some of the advocates on this issue have a different agenda in mind. It's an agenda that is essentially a kind of command and control economy, and they're people of the left. It's just a reality that the environmental movement today is characterized by people largely on the left and who have a different kind of an agenda. And as I understand the view of the right, and I disagree with it, that's why I've written about it, but I'm just trying to explain it, it is that there is a different agenda going forward, and that they think that the rest of this agenda would be pernicious and harmful to the country. And I think what they've decided to do was to just deny that the problem exists rather than to try and engage it in a serious way. And I think that's a mistake. I do think that there is a way that you can go forward while the science is clear about, I think, what's happening. Then you have these models about the future. And there, that's just simply a more open question, right, in terms of is the Earth on a road to the apocalypse, in which you can get some models to say that, or is it considerably less than that? And what are the policies that one wants to advance that's going to solve this problem? And there's a real debate going on. And beyond that, there's a more complicated issue here, which is America could do a lot. And in fact, it has. The country is, I'm sure you're familiar, but if the rest of you aren't, no country since in the last 20 years has done more to cut carbon emissions than the United States. We've actually beaten the targets that we were after. But if you're dealing with global warming, the problems here are China and India and Russia. And I think it's reasonable to say that we're not going to advance policies that are going to lead to, if not economic ruin, economic problems in America when these other countries are going through and nothing is being done there. Because as a net, very little is being done. And you're having policies that's going to hurt the United States economically, and you have to find a balance there, and you have to find out what capacity do you have to try and influence India and China and Russia and these other countries. And their response to us is, well, we're at a different point in the kind of industrial revolution. You now have the capacity because of the nature of your economy not to cut global emissions, but we're not, and if we don't, people are going to live in poverty. So it's complicated, and I don't think it's absolutely obvious what the policies should be going forward. I think there's room for debate with that, but I think the science is clear where we are, and I think the threat's real.
So you bring up the apocalypse, and I am now a bookseller, not a politician. I should say Pete has written two marvelous books, one with Michael Gerson, who was a speechwriter also for President Bush and writes opinion pieces for the Washington Post, a conservative, an excellent writer, and the other with Arthur Brooks from the American Enterprise Institute. For me, sort of the troika of remaining conservative thought. There are a lot of new, young conservative writers that have come on the scene, but Pete and Michael and Arthur Brooks really are remarkable. If you're looking to study conservative thought and philosophy, I would really encourage you to pick up their columns and read it. But there has been and by the way, those wonderful books are available at a new independent bookstore in town. I'm told.
And they're signed, too.
And they're signed copies, that's right. But that's neither here nor there. There has been in the book industry a real renewed interest in certain titles right now, I assume because of the political climate we're facing. 1984 is back on the bestseller list. The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood, sort of this dystopian science fiction book about women's rights, has made a huge comeback. It's actually back on the bestseller list. It's interesting. Brave New World is back in the mix. In fact, there was a debate in, I think, the Wall Street Journal recently about whether 1984 best represented the climate or Brave New World best represented the climate. So I'm curious as to what you think about that. Is that overstated, this return, this grasping at these apocalyptic novels? And also, I want to know, what is on your nightstand? What are you reading right now?
Okay. It's, you know, speaking about 1984 versus the Brave New World, Neil Postman wrote a great book back in the 1980s, I think, called Amusing Ourselves to Death, where that was actually his lead-in in his preface. And his concern was that it was not 1984, but it was a Brave New World, and that we were amusing ourselves to death. Do I think those are overstated? Yes, certainly I think in this country. I mean, I don't think that we're close to a dark night of authoritarian rule. As critical as I am of Donald Trump, for one thing, I think his sheer ineptness would probably prevent him from some of his maybe more authoritarian tendencies. But look, America has very strong and deep institutions, and I think that they've even shown in the first 100 days of the Trump presidency, the courts. Primarily, but others as well, that they are strong, and I don't think that the danger facing America now is a kind of 1984, Big Brother control of thing. I think that the problems we have are very different. I think that they're real. I do think one thing that does concern me is this spread throughout much of the Western world of a kind of rising illiberalism and this astonishing hemorrhage of faith in democracy, particularly among young people. There's a fellow, a lecturer at Harvard, Yasser Munk, M-O-U-N-K. He and one other person wrote a piece in the Journal of Democracy about this phenomenon that is happening. And we see it, right? And we've see it in France and in Britain with the rise of UKIP and a whole series of far right nationalist parties that are rising up. We see it in other countries like Hungary and Poland. What we are used to traditionally in the 20th century history of America was that the free world and the authoritarian or totalitarian world would be at odds and battling. What the new phenomenon here that's happening is what seems to be this spreading virus of what is a kind of what is termed by some of them as a sort of illiberal democracy. Yeah, it's illiberalism. It's the idea that liberal institutions, rule of law, minority rights don't apply, and that you need a strong man to sort of essentially take over and run the country. And as I said, if you look, if traditionally it's young people who have been the fiercest defenders of democracy. And that's really not happening. So there is a sense in the Western world and America as well that democracy is not the system that is preferred, and that it may not be up to the challenges that we face. And that, I think, is a very worrisome thing, because that's a crisis of self-confidence. And I'm just in the midst actually of doing a paper on it. So I haven't read it sufficiently to have strong views of all that is causing it. But I think some of the things that are causing it is the globalization, which we saw it really in this country
Charles Murray wrote a book a few years ago, Coming Apart, which is the bifurcation of America from the well-to-do and the blue-collar workers, which really explained the rise of Trump, which is these people who had been left behind in the modern economy. These jobs that used to be there are no longer there. So it's sort of spreading globalization, automation, and technology, right? These things can't be stopped. They shouldn't be stopped. But there is a real social dislocation. If you had a job in which, you know, you used to be on a factory line and now there are machines that are doing it, now that helps consumers. And if you were in the horse and buggy industry when the automobile came along, there was a dislocation there, and the solution wasn't to say, we're going to stop the automobiles from going forward because we've got to protect the horse and buggy industry. On the other hand, there has to be some kind of humane response to people who are feeling the effects of this dislocation. And Ben Sasse, a terrific senator from Nebraska, wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal just yesterday, I think, where he said that this may be the most dramatic and traumatic economic shift and dislocation in world history that we're going on. So I think that's part of it, and part of it is immigration. I'm very pro-immigrant. I have been my entire life. And I think America, the problem is not nearly as pronounced. But I do think in Europe, if you talk to people who certainly are not racist in Europe, there is a sense, like in the United Kingdom, they've taken in so many people from different countries that it is overwhelming them. And there's a sense in which we are no longer a country. We can't process it. Germany experienced this. Angela Merkel, I think, in a very brave and humanitarian act, took in hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees. And I thought it was a very decent thing. But there's no question that it has really caused problems within Germany, even in countries like Sweden, for goodness sakes, which have been traditionally very, very liberal. Now, because of immigration, and this one is specific to Muslim immigration, that's causing a backlash. So there are a lot of things that are going on right now that is causing a lot of disorientation, and that I think is troubling. I think we've got to get it right in this country because we're the biggest and strongest and most consequential country by far in the world. And if we don't get it right, and if we don't recover a kind of faith in democracy and begin to model it right and show that it works, then I think all bets are off. Because if America pulls back and recedes and doesn't lead in the world, and I think, as we've discovered over the last 8 years, things don't get better, they get worse. That there's a lot of chaos that can be unleashed.
So what are you reading?
Well, I can tell you one thing I'm reading, because I can prove it, which
you
is Stephen Carter wrote a book years ago called Civility, Manners, Morals, and the Etiquettes of Democracy. And that's subject that's interesting to me because Mike and I want to push a program on reclaiming democratic virtues, moderation as a kind of temperament, governing temperament, civility as a way of discourse, and compromise as a way of democracy working itself out. But gosh, you know, I'm one of those people who I can pull like two or three books off the shelf at any given moment and just begin to read again. Reading Orthodoxy by G.K. Chesterton, yeah. Because a group...
Also available at the Midtown Reader.
Get it, please, both for the book and the bookstore. I'm part of I host a monthly discussion group, and so we do sometimes essays and sometimes books, so that's one I'm reading as well. Yeah.
You have a question?
So, yeah, I'd like to maybe do a little bit of a lightning round in the audience, and then we can close after that. Quick question.
Over here. Looks like I have one here, too. So.
Okay, everybody, go fast.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for coming. I've really appreciated this.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, one of the things that you first mentioned, we were over here really giddy when you mentioned confirmation bias and motivation, motivated reasoning. And something that I've noticed is that national politics seems to be defined by platitudes and sound bites.
Yeah.
And as you alluded, in some respects, it's understandable in that it works. And also, you have a limited amount of time to get your information across. And
right.
So you reach for these things. But it seems that these sound bites and platitudes are also vehicles that enable confirmation bias and motivated reasoning. And it's local conversations like this that I think are great antidotes to that. But and so I really applaud this group for doing this, but I'm wondering, how do we translate this from the local level to the national level, where I don't see a way of getting past the platitudes and the sound bites?
On that, and that is to sort of grow off of your observation. Somebody was saying that, you know, how does the two-party system gives us sort of a binary view of the universe, right? Noticeable consequences, winners versus losers, friend versus enemy, agree versus object.
Yeah.
Let me add, put all these on the table, then you can respond.
Sure.
One of my biggest fears is that we are going to lose our leadership in the world as the greatest experiment in democracy, our wealth, and all of that, and that country like China, who has doesn't really know what democracy is, what freedom of so many things. Do you foresee, and we are going to undo ourselves because we're being so divisive, or we say we're divisive, and we can't let that happen. How do you see us still carrying the banner ahead of everybody else when we had such a monster in wealth, in size, and so many of us here in the U.S. investing in China? How do you see us still holding the banner 20, 30 years from now?
Okay, good. Any others, or should I take those? Okay. All right, that's enough. Yeah, on the confirmation bias, motivated reasoning, and sound bites in the national level, and what to do about it. I'll offer up one idea, and I'm open to others, because I don't think it's an easy or self-evident solution. I do think that part of the answer to this is political leadership, and let me explain what I mean. I do think that if we were to produce political leaders who were willing to take on their own party and their own movement rather than the other side, including very specifically on this set of issues, that would be much more effective. Because I think in the current environment, when Barack Obama decides to lecture Republicans on confirmation bias and being closed-minded, and anti-empirical, or you know, if Ronald Reagan did it to liberals and did the same thing, you're just not going to get anywhere. That's playing into a stereotype. Those people don't have any trust in the people that are saying it. They're wary of them, and the likely effect of it is to actually make the situation worse. I've been critical of Donald Trump and Republicans and Christians, so let me be critical of Barack Obama too. I felt like he had a chance in his presidency to do that, and actually when I hear Obama at times describe the situation, I agree with him. But I must say, I felt like in his conduct as president, that was not what happened. When he would talk about, he used rhetoric that had more serrated edges than a lot of recent presidents, where he would say time and time again that Republicans were putting a party ahead of country, and that they didn't care about the children that were dying. And there was just this parade of accusations of motivation that really poisoned the well. And I understand the impulse to do it, and I know it goes both ways. And I'm not saying Republicans didn't have a role in it. But in our system of government, you know, the president is primus inter pares. And you've got, and he never once did that to his own party. He never identified a Democrat and said, you know what you said was really out of bounds, and that wasn't right. And you know, liberal party, that is confirmation bias, and that's anti-empirical. It was always on the other side. And again, it happens the reverse way too. So I think one thing that would help a lot is if you got a Republican president who was able to speak to the conservative movement and challenge them on certain things and say, look, this is factually where we are, and we've got to accept the facts, and a Democrat do the same thing for liberals. I think you have to model it.
But again, I do think that in addition to that, the public is going to have to decide what they care about and what they're looking for in leaders. The trick on this confirmation bias, of course, and all of you are experiencing it, and I am too, is when we think about confirmation bias and motivated reasoning, we're always thinking about the other guy. We say, oh, yeah, that's right, I'm a liberal. And God, those conservatives, they're such confirmation bias. I see it all the time. And this just never looks within, and it's the same thing the opposite way. It's very easy to see that in other people, and often we're right to see it in other people because it is so obvious, but we're blind to seeing